I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to The Connection. Why, oh why, would we do a show about the stuff that we find revolting, that repulses us, that makes us grimace and sick to our stomach? Things like bodily fluids and excretions, the putrid smell and terrible taste of rot, the stench of decay and death, insects and rodents. Well, don't turn that dial, because disgust is a universal emotion, one that has helped us survive. It drives our behavior and our social relationships. It has inspired technology like indoor plumbing and has been used to turn us against each other. Our guest, psychologist Paul Rozin, has been studying disgust for 40 years. He's one of the foremost authorities on the subject and has helped to bring the emotion out of the closet. More recently, he has turned his attention to the role of contagion in disgust and food as well. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania and joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Paul Rozin, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Nice to be here.
So you have been studying disgust for something like 40 years. What do you know now that you didn't know 40 years ago? Was there an aha moment for you?
Well, actually, that's a very long answer.
Oh, dear.
We know a fair amount about disgust that we didn't know 40 years ago. I got into it originally because I was impressed by the fact that most disgusting foods are meat or animal products, and they're, in a way, the most nutritious foods. And why should we have such a strong negative reaction to something that's so positive and that people love, by the way?
So looking at the sort of attraction-repulsion when it comes to this idea of disgust?
Yeah, meat is a very interesting substance because people have very strong preferences for it, but very strong aversions to, like, the raw meat or to camel meat or to all sorts of things. We only eat the meat of, in the United States, 3 or 4 mammals out of 4,000. So we, and the rest of them are disgusting.
Like eyeballs, for instance.
Well, we only eat one part of most of the animals, the muscle. Some people eat liver and other things, but most people don't in this country. But also, there are 4,000 species of mammals. There are all kinds of them. And we find them disgusting.
Well, I want to get to all of that, but let me go back to some basic things about disgust. And it's described as an emotion, yeah, like sadness and happiness. And yet it seems to have this kind of biological component to it. How do you think of disgust?
Well, I think originally it's very biological, and it's about avoiding foods that are potentially dangerous. Often they're carrying infectious agents. And that's why, by the way, meat is the focus of food disgust, because meat is much more likely to carry dangerous microorganisms than plants, because animals are like us, and the thing, the microorganisms that live in them can live in us.
Plus, the smell of decaying meat.
Yes.
It's pretty disgusting.
That's one of the
versus
most disgusting.
Versus a carrot or a banana.
Yeah, a decaying carrot is not nearly as disgusting as a decaying piece of meat.
Over the years, as I said, you have been studying this for something like 40 years. Are there things that still disgust you, or have you spent so much time sort of understanding this emotion and maybe even exposing yourself to so-called disgusting things that you have a high tolerance for disgust?
Well, I had a high tolerance for disgust at the beginning.
Did you?
And I think that most people who work on something, anything, are not too upset by it. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it. I never had a problem eating insects.
Right.
And I've eaten quite a few of them. But generally, it's an interesting thing because toilet training, for example, which is, of course, a very potentially disgusting thing, has hardly been studied by psychologists, even though Freud and others made a central point about it. And that's partly because it's disgusting. Who wants to study toilet training?
Well, I want to get to toilet training as well, but let me go back again to some really basic questions here. One of the things that you have written is, anything that reminds us we're animals elicits disgust, a defense mechanism to keep human animalness out of awareness. And I thought that was pretty interesting. Can you expand on that?
Well, a lot of things that are disgusting are things that we share with animals, like body fluids, blood, you know, and all sorts of other things. So, and we don't like to think of ourselves as animals.
No.
We like to think of ourselves as better than animals. So, and one of the features of animals that we really don't like is that they die. And of course, we die too. But that animalness of us is sort of off-putting. And so many things that elicit disgust are reminders of our animal nature, like any exposure to our body substances.
Well, and animals tend to die before us. So is it also our connection to our own mortality, things that we don't like to think about because it reminds us that we're not going to live forever?
Yes, it does remind us of that. And one of the things that is very disgusting to most people is touching a dead human body.
Right.
So the death is a very important thing, first of all, in human life. That is to say, it's a very important thing how we deal with death. And so that there is a sense that we have to come live day to day in the face of eventual death. And that's a problem. We have to put it aside because if we keep thinking about it, we won't do anything.
Well, I can imagine, you know, many, 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 many years ago when we were sort of becoming human beings, that disgust would keep us away from potentially dangerous food. But I wonder about the role of disgust today. Does it still operate the same way?
Well, disgust today is similar to what it used to be, but much expanded. So what is disgusting includes things like Adolf Hitler is disgusting for most people. That was not present in our earliest days. So what's happened is that more and more categories of things have become disgusting, including animal reminders. I don't think they were probably disgusting to people,
right?
20,000 years ago or so.
I have a particular memory as a child of sitting in front of a plate of overcooked squash and feeling absolute disgust. In fact, as I say it now, I can remember that feeling of revulsion. It looked horrible. It smelled horrible. I didn't want to eat it. Are there sort of unique then disgust experiences that we all have?
Yes, I think most of us have it. And of course, we run into, for example, the universal disgust is feces.
Right.
And we all have some dealings with feces, of course, our own all the time, but also other situations, like stepping in dog poo. Yeah.
So that's the kind of universal. But I wonder whether we sort of develop a sense of disgust if we've had a so-called bad experience with, let's say, food.
You can avoid a certain food, for example, if you've had a disgust experience with it. That means not only the example you gave where you had squash, but something that you ate that touched something offensive, for example. So that then you might not want to eat it anymore. That's a pretty common event in human life of getting to dislike a food because of an unpleasant experience with it.
Well, you mentioned feces, and I should say to our listeners, we're going to talk about all of this, but you have talked about, and I've probably written about, what happens if people are given two pieces of chocolate, one that looks like a piece of chocolate and one that looks like dog poop, and the kind of sense of revulsion that we have with the chocolate dog poop. What is going on there?
Well, that's very striking. It's almost everybody shows this, not everybody, but almost everybody. And that is that something looks like, well, we have a basic understanding of the world that has nothing to do with disgust.
Right.
If it looks like X, it's X. If it looks like a tiger, it's a tiger. That was true a long time ago. Now, if it looks like a tiger, it's a picture of a tiger, and you shouldn't get used to it. But we still see a certain amount of fear about that. But in the case of the chocolate dog do, we have a piece of our brain that's saying, looks like poop is poop. And even though we know that that's not true, and we can override it, and we can get people to eat chocolate dog do, for example, if they like chocolate, by saying, we'll give you $10 to eat it. Oh, yeah, sure.
So they do it for $10?
Well, I mean, we
maybe a little more than that.
No, it depends on the person, but, yeah. But basically, there's a piece of us that knows that it's okay, that it's really chocolate. But we have this quick, intuitive feeling that this is bad stuff.
Is that the sort of biology at work? I mean, could you stimulate our brains, for instance, to make us feel disgust about something?
Well, one way to get the brain to feel disgust in the absence of a disgust elicitor is to make it look like something disgusting. And so our brain is fooled in a sense. I mean, even if it knows that it's an imitation, it's often put off by it because we can't overrule that the strong sense, unless we're highly motivated, like by money.
By money, yeah. But this sort of the association is just so powerfully strong.
Yes.
You had a pretty famous experiment, the dead cockroach and drink test, which I think is sort of related to what we were talking about. How did that work?
Well, okay, so people are brought into the lab, and we have two cups of fruit juice, say apple and grape, and we take one of them. They drink a little, it's fine. And then we put a birthday candle from a birthday cake in, take it, dip it out, that's no problem. The other one, we take a dead cockroach and just dip it in, boom, boom, and they won't touch it. Right? And you say, why? And the typical answer is, well, cockroaches are disease vectors, and you have, put germs into the thing. So we repeat it with a sterilized cockroach. Now, that's safer than your fork. But people say, oh, I still don't want it. So this is a sort of a top-down, the brain is looking at it and trying to explain its behavior, and it comes up with a reasonable account, which turns out to be not the case.
But again, the association is there. Are there sex and gender differences when it comes to disgust?
Women tend to be more disgust-sensitive than men, but it's not a big effect, but it's there.
Do you think it's because I have always had a theory that women have a better sense of smell than men? That has been my experience.
I think they may have a better sense of smell, but I don't. But it's often the disgusting things don't smell, like the chug a dog doesn't smell. So I don't know that that's the reason. I'm not sure I know why women have women are generally more protective, at least in this culture. But I think generally, they're more worried about infection. They care more about health. They care more not only about their own health, but their family's health than men do.
We're almost about a break here, but I wonder about, we've been talking about disgust. And we, we talk about some people having very strong stomachs, their sort of ability to maybe withstand something that is disgusting.
Yeah.
I mean, is there a pretty big range of reaction to disgust when you look at humans?
There's a very wide range, and we can measure that. So at one extreme, you have people who will not blow their nose in a brand new piece of toilet paper.
Oh.
And at the other end, you have people who eat insects and, just don't have any problems. But and there are very few people who have no disgust. But there are people who are very high in disgust and people who hardly pay attention to it.
And it is I want to pick up on this, but it is universal. It's something that's experienced around the world?
Yes. As far as we know, no one's tested most of the cultures of the world.
Right.
But as far as we know, yes.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And yes, we are talking about disgust today on The Connection. And talking with Paul Rozin, he has been studying disgust for something like 40 years. He's currently professor emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Live Arts proudly presents Parsons Dance on May 30th and 31st. With bold athleticism and witty choreography, the company performs classics as well as Philadelphia premieres, including works set to jazz legend Miles Davis and singer-songwriter Bill Withers, known for hits such as Ain't No Sunshine, Lean On Me, and Just the Two of Us. Tickets for Parsons Dance on May 30th and 31st and more information are at PennLiveArts.org. That's PennLiveArts.org.
Studio 2 is heading back on the road for our next live event.
On Thursday, May 22nd at 6 p.m., we'll be at Theater N in Wilmington, Delaware for an in-depth conversation with John Carney.
After two terms as governor, Carney became mayor of Wilmington this year and will pick his brain on lessons learned, his vision for the future, and the threat of big companies leaving Delaware to incorporate in other states.
The event is free and open to the public, but you need to register at whyy.org/events.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And yes, we're talking about rotten food, the smell of decay, rodents and insects, the psychology of disgust, and what it reveals about human nature. And our guest is psychologist Paul Rozin, a leading expert on this topic of disgust. We'll be talking more about some of his new research having to do with food and contagion. So I want to make sure we save a little time for that. Well, let's go back to some basic things about disgust. As you mentioned, it seems like a uniquely human trait. Do other animals feel disgust? Do we know?
Well, of course, we don't know if they feel disgust because we can't ask them. But there's no evidence that animals have anything like disgust. They have, of course, avoidance of foods. Right. They have a face, which is a little bit like a disgust face, with a gape. Right. There's two disgust faces. One is a gape, lower lip down. Another is a raising of the upper lip.
Right.
And that's not common in animals, I don't think, for disgusting things. They don't tend to avoid... they may avoid body products, but a lot of animals eat feces. Rats eat their own feces regularly. And as far as we know, and there's one feature of disgust that we know animals don't have, which is contamination or contagion. Huh. That if something disgusting touches something otherwise edible, we won't eat it, the cockroach and juice. There's no evidence for anything like that in animals.
Well, it's interesting, and picking up on that, if we see a hair in a soup or in a salad, it often is that feeling of disgust.
Yeah.
Why is that? Because, you know, we touch other people's heads and head of hair. What is it about a piece of a slip of hair in our food that is so disgusting?
Well, there's something about food that's special. You put it in your body.
That's true.
We don't do other things.
Right.
We don't put other things. And by the way, it's the only thing really we put in our body. There's a little sexual stuff there, but except for that, basically everything comes in the mouth hole. And we care deeply about what gets in. We like to put stuff in the mouth, but we care a lot about what goes in. And so the hair is attaching itself to a very personal and intimate activity of ours.
And the idea, sort of an alarm goes off saying this could be contaminated or somehow unhealthy?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an actual fact. Probably there's not much risk of hair, right. but we have that general view that's body products are disgusting. Most of them are not dangerous.
Right.
But, yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was thinking of, sort of a weird segue, but Senator Amy Klobuchar, this was when I think she was running for president, and there was a story about her that she was eating a salad with her comb. And I remember the sort of revulsion that people had when they heard that story. Yeah. Now, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, well, the comb is a dirty thing. I mean, it's not really dirty.
No.
But, you know, it's body care substance, something. So, yeah, I mean, that's typical, of what people would feel disgusted by. People don't like the idea of using someone else's comb.
No, no.
I mean, you know, and there's a very special thing about disgust. We live with our own body, of course, all the time, and our body's disgust is lower for that reason. And also our body's less threatening to us. For example, our stool is probably less threatening to eat than someone else's because we already have that stuff in us.
Because it's personal and it's...
Well, I mean, from the point of view of danger, it's not very dangerous. From the point of, and a lot of animals eat their own feces.
Right.
But it's also just not... we live with it. I mean, we live with a big pile of feces in our body all the time. Now, we have to come to terms with that.
Right. I just rolled my eyes.
Yeah,
yes,
we have, mucus. We have all sorts of stuff in our body. And, of course, we don't see it. But if, for example, you spit in a glass of water, people will typically not be willing to drink that water.
Right.
Now, that spit was just in their mouth. I mean, it's sort of weird, but that's the way they feel.
Because it's this body, someone else's body fluid.
Well, it's their body fluid. They
exactly.
But they come to terms with the fact that they're filled with disgust. But if it's called to their attention by spitting in a glass of water, they don't want it.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about babies. I mean, are babies born with a sense of disgust, or is that something that either comes from toilet training or something that they learn from experience?
Babies do not show disgust. They show an aversion to certain tastes, like bitter tastes, and they show a face that's somewhat similar to a disgust face. But they don't. As far as we know, disgust doesn't appear till 3, 4, or 5 years of age.
Right.
And one way we know that is because if you drop the cockroach in something that the baby is eating, they will not mind that at all until about 5 years of
right.
age.
So is that something that they've learned, or is it from toilet training that we learn that some things are disgusting and some things are not?
Well, you know, surprisingly, we don't know the answer to that. It's probably true that toilet training is the first disgust experience. And it's probably because as the parents are dealing with toilet training, they're making comments about how disgusting it is and so on. Because little kids play with their feces and eat it. And so they learn, that's the first thing they learn they shouldn't eat. And it's probably the first disgust. But we don't actually know how that's communicated to kids. Because nobody studies toilet training.
Yeah. And again, because it just has this sort of mist of disgust around
it. Yeah, well, it is. It's not a mist. It's very disgusting.
Yeah.
Though, you know, parents are
wrong word there, yeah.
Yeah. Parents are typically not so upset about their own children's feces as they're not about their own feces. But they are upset about it. And nobody seems to want to study something so disgusting.
And yet, I think for parents of young babies, there's a lot of talk about poop, right? How was the poop today? That kind of thing.
Yes, and also problems with the poop. It's funny color, all kinds of stuff goes on, yes. Some people have trouble talking about it. Other people, it's perfectly natural to talk about it.
Yeah, let me just quickly reintroduce you. And yes, we're talking about disgust today on The Connection and talking with psychologist Paul Rozin. He's professor emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania. And for decades now, he has been doing experiments on and exploring this whole notion of disgust, which drives a lot of human behavior. And that's what we're talking about today on The Connection. I wonder, too, when in talking about disgust, whether if we have sort of frequent contact, sort of a desensitization bunch of experiences, can we then learn to eat worms, for instance, which I think for most people that would be a hard thing to climb over. How does that work?
You can definitely develop a taste for something that you originally found disgusting. By the way, stinky cheese is a perfectly good example. Many people overcome the disgust there. So, yes, experience and exposure does it. We did one study on cadavers where medical students, of course, dissect the cadaver. And they're disgusted by the cadaver, but by the time they're finished dissecting it, there's very little disgust to it. But they're still disgusted to a live, dead body. So, you know, it's very narrow kind of learning, but it does occur.
But you can, I mean, maybe not for everything or everybody, but over time... And you mentioned stinky cheese, and I think, you know, and even thinking of children, for the most part, children don't want to eat stinky cheese.
Right.
I mean, it's
for
rotting
them,
milk.
It's poop.
Yeah, and it has a very pungent smell, but over time, we begin to think of it as a delicacy. So what has happened to our sense of taste and sense of disgust?
Well, there's no change in the sense of taste per se, but... We get to like a lot of things, not just disgusting things. We get to like beer, which is bitter. We get to like coffee, which is bitter. We get to like spicy food, which little kids don't like. Humans are, by the way, special in this characteristic. We get to like all kinds of negative things.
Right.
We're the only species that does that, and that includes things like jumping out of airplanes and going down roller coasters. Can you imagine your dog going into a roller coaster and enjoying it?
No, he would not like that.
No, so we are a species that seems to get to like lots of things that our body is saying to us. Don't do this, get out of here.
You, in fact, have coined a name for that, benign masochism.
Yes, that's right. Because it's benign because we're not really in danger going down a roller coaster. But our body thinks we are, so the body's fear response to the roller coaster becomes a part of the pleasure of going down because your body is saying, get out of here. And you're saying, it's okay. and that sort of mind over body. And it's very common in humans. Most cultures have stinky food that they eat, not always stinky cheese, but fish sauce and Southeast Asia and so on. So we do all kinds of things. Roller coasters are popular. So it's a feature of human, being human.
to both sort of not just love and hate, but be excited and also be terrified.
Yes.
Of the same experience.
Yes, but our the terrified part is something that we know at a higher level is not really threatening, like the roller coaster.
Right.
Or the hot food that you eat. Your mouth is not going to peel off when you eat a hot food, spicy food, but it feels like it is.
Do you watch those shows on TV where people are eating, you know, crickets and, or, I don't know, all sorts of horrible, well, potentially horrible
yes,
food
and they eat hot food, you know, and they eat as much hot food as they can in 5 minutes, and it's amazing to watch. and it's, people enjoy watching it.
Right. They get that kind of vicarious, I guess, pleasure out of it.
Yeah, it's a vicarious pleasure.
You talk about contamination, and I would assume part of that is partly at work when we buy clothes or T-shirts that have a hero on the front, you know, someone that we admire. But you've also done some really interesting research about, you know, Hitler's sweater. Like, who would want to maybe buy or even wear, I guess, wear a sweater that Hitler wore? What are you getting at there?
Well, okay, so it started with work on disgust. And it was the cockroach spoiling the juice that it went into. And it turns out that that's very common. That's a feature of disgusting things, that when they touch something, they render it inedible. And we call that contagion. It's an old principle in anthropology. When something touches something else, it passes its properties into it. But that's not just about food. So Hitler's sweater, Hitler is a very negative person. He touches his clothes, and his clothes therefore have something of Hitler in them. And it's not clear what that Hitler is. It doesn't seem like it's molecules of Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can wash the sweater, you can unweave it and weave it back. It doesn't matter. It's still got Hitler in it. So it's a more spiritual thing that's gotten in there. It's not really physical, but it's very powerful. And on the positive side, not as strong in the positive side, but you have people who really crave owning and touching and wearing clothing that was worn by a hero. And now we've recently been studying why people like grandma's food so much, you know. And there's a sense, one factor is a sense in which grandma's in there.
Right. The idea that it's an interesting... I don't want to call it cannibalism, but it's not unrelated to that, isn't it?
No, it's not unrelated to cannibalism. A lot of cannibalism, by the way, it's pretty much out of existence now.
Right.
But a lot of it was what's called endocannibalism, meaning eating people that you love when they die and taking them into yourself as a form of incorporating something you love. So that's not like exocannibalism, eating the enemy.
Yeah.
But that's a very important idea. And yes, it is. The most intimate way that you can connect to someone is to eat them, in a sense, or eat something of theirs.
Which is sexual as well, right?
Oh,
as
absolutely.
You mentioned earlier. I mean, the idea of, sex is a kind of cannibalism.
Well, don't spoil sex for people by coming up with that idea. But it is true that in sex, we do things that are normally disgusting.
Right.
So, for example, orogenital sex is something that you would be very offended doing to anyone but someone you cared about. Right. So that at things that are negative, or saliva in kissing, there's things that are often negative become either neutral or positive in a sexual relationship.
Right.
So that's another case where we suspend disgust.
Let me ask you a little bit more about meat. And as you said, obviously there are vegans and vegetarians and whole countries that really eschew the idea of eating meat. And as you mentioned, we only eat certain parts of animals if we do eat meat. But I've always wondered, people went to a slaughterhouse, would they come out still eating meat? And it wouldn't be just horrifying, as I understand it, but whether it would also be disgusting, because all of a sudden you see, oh, this is where my, you know, my steak comes from.
Yeah, well, you can't tour its slaughterhouse anymore, as far as I know.
Yes, I'm sure.
And the reason for that was that it was making anti-meat people. And the meat business doesn't want people to be negative about meat. So there is a definite feeling. When we eat meat, we don't tend to think animal. You know, when you eat a steak, you're not thinking cow. Right. And if you do think cow, that's not good. And we, especially in the United States, make sure that people don't think of mammal meat as animal meat. So we package it in supermarkets in plastic. No kid would know that that was a piece of a pig. Now, in Europe and many other parts of the world, they're much less sensitive to that. Right. They'll have a whole animal carcasses hanging in a supermarket. So we eat meat without thinking animal too much. And if you end up, I actually had an experience myself of this. I ordered in France. I wouldn't eat rabbit. I don't eat mammals anymore. But I did at the time. And I ordered some pasta with rabbit. And it turned out it was a whole rabbit opened on the plate and with a fur and everything. And I just couldn't eat it. I couldn't eat it.
Yeah, yeah. We were also wondering about lab-grown meat. Does that open up a whole sort of new way of thinking about meat? And obviously it takes away the murder part of it.
Yes, it takes away. It's very, lab-grown meat is interesting because it should be appealing to people because the taste of meat is desirable to almost everyone. And no animals are dying. Now, at the moment, it's very expensive, so it isn't ecologically sensible because we spend too much money on it that we could spend on other things. But people tend to find lab meat disgusting. And it's not clear why they do, because it doesn't, well, it's meat, and meat tends to be disgusting.
Right.
But it's regular cells from the meat, and it's no animal was suffering, so.
Yeah, so why wouldn't that sort of solve that particular problem? Is it because it's made in a lab and that feels kind of sterile and...
It's unnatural.
Yeah,
and that's another feature. Disgust, of course, is quite natural. I mean, most disgusting things are natural things.
Right.
But, that's right. So I don't know... I don't know exactly why. We're looking at this now. I don't know why cultured meat is so disgusting to people. Insects, we understand in a way. I mean, they're animals, and animals we don't eat are disgusting. But cultured meat should be appealing. And now, some vegetarians are vegetarians because of health. They think meat is unhealthy. And for them, cultured meat would be unhealthy too,
right,
but not disgusting.
Right.
Now, for some vegetarians, meat is disgusting, by the way, all meat. But it's not clear what's going on there.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is psychologist Paul Rozin. And for years now, he has been studying this emotion, this reaction, disgust. And it takes us in many different directions, everything from Hitler's sweater to eating insects, which I do want to talk about after this very short break. He is professor emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Man supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra returns to the Man Center this summer for Music Under the Stars, featuring Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, Piano Concerto No. 4, and more on June 17th. Plus, a collaboration with the Grammy, Emmy, and Tony Award-winning singer and Wicked actress Cynthia Erivo on June 21st. Ticket details at mancenter.org. That's mancenter.org.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. President Trump's visit to the Persian Gulf has reset many of the diplomatic and economic relationships in the Middle East. Meanwhile, back in D.C., Speaker Mike Johnson tries to wrangle Republicans around Trump's big budget deal. We'll discuss in our weekly Politics Roundtable next time on Here and Now.
Weekdays at 1 on WHYY.
That's disgusting.
That's disgusting.
That's disgusting.
Oh, my God. That's disgusting.
Disgusting. You're like an animal.
We are talking about disgusting today on The Connection. And again, our guest is psychologist Paul Rozin, and he is a leading expert on disgust. I wanted to play that very short clip only because I think the way people say, "Ooh, that's disgusting," even the way we say the word is filled with disgust.
Well, it's very negative. And it's very personal because it's, well, because much of the, some of the disgust we see is not directly threatening. And by the way, we talked before about benign masochism.
Yeah.
You can enjoy disgust. Now, there's disgust humor, first of all.
Right.
Little boys love to disgust little girls by talking about some poop or something or other. And if you just think about it, if you step in dog doo, that's disgusting. It's not funny. But if someone across the street in a tuxedo steps in dog doo,
it's hilarious.
That's pretty amusing.
Right. And I think it's even beyond children. I mean, I think, you know, it's a kind of gross adult humor.
But it's also, it's kind of benign masochism. You know, there's no threat to you by someone across the street stepping in dog doo.
And threat, I guess, is, I mean, if we think about disgust, we should think about the word threat, that that's sort of happening unconsciously or subconsciously.
Yeah, I think that we sort of feel that it's going to harm us. Though in actual fact, much of what's disgusting is harmless.
Well, let's talk about insects. And my husband and I were in Mexico, in Oaxaca, a little more than a year ago. And, you know, they eat insects down there. And we ate insects.
Good for you.
And I had a salad with a sprinkling of something, cockroaches. I'm not even sure
what it was. It wasn't cockroaches.
No, it wasn't cockroaches, but it was...
crickets, usually.
It was probably crickets, exactly. Yeah. And tasteless, kind of crunchy.
Yeah.
It was okay. And funny story, my husband ordered a steak with ants on top.
Live or dead?
You know, we never got that far because they came out of the kitchen and said, "So sorry, we're out of ants today."
Oh, for God's sake. So we'll have uncles.
Yeah. Exactly. But so how do we get people to eat insects? Because they're plentiful and they're full of protein.
Yes, one of the negative sides of disgust is it keeps us from eating things that are good for us. And insects are mostly non-toxic. It depends on the species, but usually non-toxic. They're very nutritious. They're high in protein, low in carbohydrate, and they're plentiful. And you can, by the way, farm them very inexpensively in very little space. Very little of that is done. Even in parts of the world where insects are eaten a lot, like Mexico, Southeast Asia, they don't tend to farm them much. And that's a puzzling thing because humans have come to farm all sorts of things that they liked and to get more of them. And it's puzzling why they don't do that.
Yeah.
But in any event, insects are not bad tasting. They don't taste like meat, unlike cultured meat. They don't taste like meat, but they don't taste bad. They're sort of a little nutty flavor.
Yeah, nutty.
Crispy.
Yeah.
Crispy. Now, some of them are not crispy like mealworms. Larvae of insects are often eaten too in Mexico, among other places, but they're not bad tasting, and they could be a part of the world's food supply. They are billions of people eat insects every day, but the nice thing about them is that they're cheap, they're easy to get, they're healthy, and it's a shame that people are put off by eating them.
Well, how would you do an advertising campaign then to get people to eat insects? Is to get over that, whatever that disgust is about.
Well, the one way you do it, and it's, by the way, people in Holland in particular, there's a lot of commercial products that have insects in them. And the way you do it is by using insect powder so you don't see the insects. It's ground up insects. Mm-hmm. And it's like flour, and you put it in food originally at a low level so that people they don't taste it, and it's not there, and it's people, they just feel virtuous for sustainability eating things with insects. And then you can increase the amount of insects in them. And that's happened. And there are bars, insect bars. You can get them here, too.
Yeah.
I have no problem eating whole insects, but insect bars taste like regular bars or whatever they are. Because insects don't have a strong taste.
Right.
So they don't sort of dominate what you put them in.
I was reading when you look at not what's on the label in a grocery store, but if you dig deep, like what is actually in, let's say, peanut butter or tomato sauce, There probably are some insects in there. We just don't.
The federal.
Go ahead.
The federal agricultural law in the United States allows a certain level of insect in flour, for example, because you can't get rid of them.
Right.
But it's a low level. But it's enough to be contaminating psychologically. But people just, we just don't think about all the contamination in our life. You know, when you go to a restaurant and you serve the plate or something, you don't think about the people in the kitchen who touch the food. You don't think about the fact that that plate was used by other people. You don't think about the fact that the chair you're sitting in was sat in by other people. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff that we have to do to live with disgust. We have to put it aside, not think about it, unless it hits us in the face.
I was reading about some of these new weight loss drugs, and one of the side effects, I don't think it's true for everybody, is nausea. I mean, the idea is you just, the food sort of makes you feel, I think, full very quickly, but also can make you feel nauseous. So it's interesting that have we introduced disgust into weight loss, the idea of having a kind of aversion to food?
Well, you could, but you know, you can be nauseous without being disgusted. I mean, when you get motion sickness, for example,
right.
You're nauseous with that. So nausea is a concomitant of disgust for sure, but it isn't a necessary condition, and it is also not necessarily tied to disgust. But it is interesting that one way to stop eating a food is to get nauseous when you eat it.
Yeah,
very strong effect, and so that could be a problem. But I don't know how. I don't think the nausea is very severe.
Let me talk a little bit about, I guess, moral disgust. I mean, this idea that we have judgments about people based on who we think they are, or perhaps what they have done or what they have said. Where does I guess, moral disgust come from? And as you say, disgust has sort of come out of the Serengeti and become part of our psychological experiences.
Yeah, well, so the food disgust, which is probably the original form, and the word disgust means bad taste, by the way.
Oh, right, disgust.
But it expands, and in the latest, the most interesting expansion way is that certain moral violations are thought to be disgusting. Now, not all.
Right.
And they tend to be bodily things like incest, and they tend to be. Also, Richard Schrader, who's an anthropologist, has described one type of morality as a morality of divinity. It's a sacredness, a pollution of sacred things. So that's not the same as the usual Western moral issue. It's a low form of morality in the sense in the United States, that is, most people don't have a lot of it. Whereas in India, for example, it's very common.
What does that mean?
Well, so for example, let me just think of a good example. Okay, burning the American flag.
Right.
Now, that's a sacred object, and you burn. No one's hurt when you burn the American flag. Most morality is about hurting other people. Huh. It's immoral to hurt others. That's our basic moral system, which Schrader describes as a different kind of morality. But divinity morality is things like burning the flag, using a crucifix for doorstop, and also incest and things, the bodily things. We haven't yet agreed on what types of moral offenses are disgusting. It could be bodily, it could be divinity violations. We're not really sure. But they're a subset of moral things, and not most moral things. Most moral things like stealing and fraud are not disgusting to people.
Right.
They cause anger, which is the most common moral emotion, not disgust.
Not disgust. But I wonder because disgust has this sort of biological component.
Yeah.
Whether it, I don't know if it's more powerful, but if there's just something, because you feel it bodily, that it has a more powerful impact.
Yes, but an interesting thing about disgust is people's typical reaction to it is withdrawal. You move away. A typical reaction to anger is approach. Mm-hmm. You're going to stop it. So it's sort of an interesting difference between these two moral emotions. And we're just this very active field now, studying moral disgust, what it is, what characterize it, what parts of the brain are involved. All sorts of stuff is going on now in that area.
Do we know yet, or we're just at the beginning?
There's a lot of work, but it's a lot of argumentation. Because there are people who don't think there's anything really that's moral disgust, and there are people who think there's a lot of it. And the question is, how do you describe those things, the events that are morally disgusting? We all agree Hitler is morally disgusting. And one of the things about moral disgust is the if there is an entity that's involved, like Hitler, he's contaminating.
Right, and we're back to Hitler's sweater, but that notion. Also, and I'm thinking about how disgust can be used to divide us, and, you know, I hate going back to Hitler again, but he did call Jews a maggot in a rotting body, among other
cockroach, yes.
Yes, among other things. I mean, to be honest with you, President Trump has talked about migrants carrying contagious diseases.
Yes.
He talked about S-hole countries in Africa,
yes,
which has a kind of disgust aspect
Absolutely.
To it. I mean, how do you see that, and how you can see how powerful that sort of metaphor is for dividing people and scapegoating people?
Yes, well, there is a sense in which outgroups are disgusting. So certainly people would be much more upset about wearing the clothing someone in an outgroup wore than someone in an in-group.
Right.
And so, yeah, it does play a role in prejudice and racial prejudice and the ethnic prejudice. And it's unfortunate because it can be pretty powerful.
Yeah, because it can be such a motivator. I mean, looking at what Hitler was able to do to sort of motivate a whole country, largely, to exterminate other people.
We don't know, actually. Interesting question of how the average German during World War II was actually disgusted by Jews. I mean, that was the aim of the... Right. They were described as both disgusting and also, you know, violating, taking money and all sorts of other things. But we don't know how the average German felt about Jews, not the Nazis, but the average German.
Yeah.
So I don't know the answer to that.
Do you see a connection between disgust and disdain? And I ask that because I remember interviewing a psychologist couple who studied couples. And one of the sort of hallmarks of a couple that's in trouble is if they have disdain for each other.
Yeah.
And as I was thinking about disgust, I was just wondering if there's some connection between disgust and disdain.
Well, okay, and the word that makes that link is contempt.
Ah.
So right. Contempt is related to disgust. Facially, it's similar, but it's different in a number of ways. It's looking down on something, but if this contempt is present in a relationship, it's not a good sign for the future of the relationship. Disgust is less common in a relationship, but it can happen. But contempt, which is related, we don't know much about contempt.
But when you see it or feel it, it's a pretty powerful emotion.
Absolutely, and it's related to disgust, clearly.
You have been, and you referenced this earlier, sort of looking at food cultures and comparing France and America.
Yeah.
Having just been in France, and still recovering from a wonderful chocolate mousse I had a couple of weeks ago. What do you see as these two countries create and enjoy or maybe find disgust in food?
Well, my interest in France and the United States has nothing to do with disgust. It has to do with the fact that French seem to have a more positive relationship to food. And one reason is that they don't think of every bite as something that's going to affect their health.
Oh.
So they tend to think of food as an experience in the mouth, yum, whereas we often think of food as something going into our blood vessels. And that changes the way we think about food. And there's a lot of different ways in which that manifests. But French think more about, there's much more tradition around food in France. The meal is a much more scripted event. People don't get up in the middle of a meal and walk out. They tend to all eat the same thing. There's all sorts of stuff going on. It's more communal. And in the United States, the meal has started to degenerate. Mm-hmm. Everyone eats their favorite thing, often while they're on their cell phone, and often not even at the same table. And that's an unfortunate thing because First of all, the dinner meal is the one place where the family tends to get together. And it's not serving that function as much anymore. And by eating the same food, you're both, in terms of contagion, you're incorporating your mother's food, and you're all eating the same food, you're feeling closer. All sorts of stuff is going on there. And that's all gone when you are on your cell phone eating your macaroni and cheese, which your neighbor doesn't like.
Yeah.
The person next to you, you know.
Right.
So there's a whole bunch of stuff that's going on between France and the United States. And I think they basically have a better way of dealing with food. Not a better way of dealing with life, but a better way of dealing with food.
And is that in part tradition, culture?
Yeah.
I mean, there is something obviously about French food, and just even walking around and looking in a store window, you see just like works of art.
That's
basically
true. But you know, it's interesting that the French don't snack much.
Right.
And Americans snack all the time.
Right.
So the meal is an event for the French. And, you know, food doesn't tend to spill out into the rest of their life. And they don't eat walking. They don't eat while standing up. You know, there's a whole bunch of things. And it's, I think, 100 years ago, our eating was more like the French's than it is now. Much more familial, focused on the meal and not all the snacks.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have... The food industry makes this stuff because we want it. I don't hold the food industry to the same negative way that many people. I don't think they're great, but they're trying to cater to what people want. Well, people want sugar, they want fat, and they want it all the time, and they'll give it to us.
Well, we got to leave it there. Paul Rozin, thank you for joining us today on The Connection.
My pleasure.
And again, he is a leading authority on this this emotion of disgust. He's professor emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks very much. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection. The show was produced by Debbie Bilder with Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.